The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Now, tonight, I've been asked to talk about the past as a guide to the future, and I have to admit I'm as intrigued by some of this as you are. Listening to what has been said so far, I realize how easy it is to reconstruct history. I thought it was only my father when he used to talk about the miles he walked to school growing up in Florida, sometimes through deep snow. But I realize after this introduction and other things, we all have a way of reconstructing history, and yet things change and they look so different. Recall going back to the little town where I grew up. Boy, did things look different there. It looked so much smaller. And when I had been a boy, that world looked so huge. How different. Now that probably 2/3 of my life has passed, not knowing the future, but wondering, it is interesting to reflect on what may be ahead. And of course, none of us really know for sure. As the great theologian put it, the future ain't what it used to be. But even at that, none of us really know what it is and what lies ahead. There's an old Chinese proverb. As a matter of fact, Toffler quotes it in his introduction to Future Shock. It is, to prophesy is difficult, and especially in regard to the future. So thinking of these two things tonight, on the one hand, how easy it is to wrongly reconstruct the past and how easy it is to make mistakes in anticipating the future, you can imagine how nervous I may be thinking about the remarks I'm going to make as one who is an adventurer with the Lord in this earthly pilgrimage. I'm going to ask you to think with me about this difficulty as we look at what some people have predicted in this past century. A couple of examples. Harper's Weekly, 1902. The actual building of roads devoted to motor cars is not for the near future, in spite of many rumors to that effect. Boy, what a prediction. Just a few years later, the Bronx River Parkway was complete and cars were zipping along it regularly. In 1901, Wilbur Wright told his brother Orville, humans would not fly for at least another 50 years. And you know what happened 2 years later at Kitty Hawk. In 1932, Winston Churchill predicted we would escape the absurdity of growing a whole chicken by the year 2000, being able to grow wings and breasts and other parts separately so we could cook all we wanted that way. He may have been a great leader, but not a great prognosticator. And then you have Thomas Watson of IBM, who said, there is a world market for maybe 5 computers. Thomas Watson, chairman of IBM. Amazing, isn't it? Recently, I was looking at January issue of Time, and notice an article on the Y2K problem and what may be coming. I won't tell you where this fellow is from or what his occupation is. His name is Brian Elder. And he's predicting that the lights will go off on January the 1st. There will be a realignment of the planets in May. And the Earth will burn up. Be interesting to look forward to that. So much for predictions. It is so easy to predict things and then to be dead wrong. I mean, it's as easy to predict the future as it is the score of a ball game before it starts or who's going to win the lottery. none of which we do very well. And we may as well admit that at the outset. And when you think about it, just looking back on the things that have happened, even in one century, sometimes overwhelms us. It's hard to imagine. So much has actually occurred. Now, let me just for a moment ask you to think with me about where we were 100 years ago, and then what has happened in the ensuing century, because it helps set the stage for what we want to talk about. The 1890s, 100 years ago. At that time, America was a nation of struggling farmers, miners, trappers, and household servants, most of whom worked about 60 to 80 hours a week in manual labor. Mental work was the exception. I'm sure there was some of it, even on the part of those who were manual laborers. But boy, what a different world. It took 43% of the population to produce the food that people ate. Today, less than 2% of the population produces that food. And as late as the 1940s, 40% of the population were doing factory work, whereas now that number is 15% and falling steadily. A sure sign of the post-industrial information age. Comfortable offices, job security, human rights, medical and pension benefits were unknown. Only 2% of the population attended college, and 14% attended high school and graduated 100 years ago. Most children had to work on the farm, and they dropped out of school to do so. Basic clerical work was beyond the training of most people. That's hard to believe. The standard of living then was close to that of Mexico today, and what we now take for granted was unaffordable to most people. There were few modern conveniences. There were few when I was a boy. Cars were not for the average person. There were no paved roads, no telephones, no indoor plumbing, no electricity for lights and houses, no TVs, stereos, power tools, no skyscrapers or air conditioning, no synthetic fibers or plastic, no planes, no variety of canned, frozen, or packaged foods of today's supermarkets, no aspirin, no razor blades, no tea bags, no ice cream cones, no Coca-Cola, no computers, faxes, or cell phones, and no income tax. So even in the industrial age of the 1890s, barely 25% of the population lived in cities like Philadelphia. As a matter of fact, 60% of the population lived in little towns of 2,500 people or less. That's how much the world has changed in 100 years. Almost a complete reversal from the rural areas to the city as far as demographics. Then take that and think about that some of the major events and people of this 20th century. First of all, you have the great world wars. World War I, World War II, followed by the Korean War, and then the war in Vietnam. Four great wars, all of them leaving quite an impact on those of us who lived during those periods of time. We've been reminded of that, of World War II, just lately by the film Saving Private Ryan. Inextricably tied to those wars is the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima on August the 6th, 1945, soon after at Nagasaki. That changed the way we look at our world. Early in the century, there was the Bolshevik Revolution. Later in the century, the Cultural Revolution. One in Russia, the other in China. Then, toward the end of this century, you had the collapse of the Iron Curtain and the Berlin Wall. There was earlier in the century the enduring poverty and suffering of the Great Depression in this country, and it left a lasting mark on those who lived through it. My father-in-law was one of those who talked about that, and it forever affected the way he viewed banks and money. It was in this century in the year 1920 that women received the right to vote. In this century, we saw the rise of media influence, the first commercial radio broadcasting. And Brinkley, in his memoirs, has a fascinating story of the whole history of this media development. The first telecast was of the opening of the World's Fair in 1939. Then we had the social upheaval of the 60s and 70s, arriving very colorfully, where the hippies, the peaceniks, the flower children, who tuned in, turned on, and dropped out. There was the civil rights movement, erupting in the South and engulfing the whole nation. And when you think about the church particularly, you realize what a century this has been. There was the fundamentalist modernist controversy, a defining experience early in the century, followed some years later by the emergence of evangelicalism as a major movement, including the founding of the Evangelical Theological Society, the National Association of Evangelicals. In mid-century, you had the arrival of Campus Crusade for Christ. This was the century of Billy Graham, of C.S. Lewis, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, Mother Teresa. It was the century when Pentecostalism arrived in power and grew rapidly in numbers into a mighty charismatic movement that influenced almost all denominations. It was also the century of the founding of a National Council of Churches, the World Council of Churches, and Vatican II. It was a century of neo-orthodoxy, the death of God theology and situation ethics, and much more. This was the century when the computer was invented. In 1946, the electronic numerical integrator and calculator, as it was called, developed by Elkhart and Motley at the University of Pennsylvania, was demonstrated not many miles from here. This was the century of space. On March the 26th, 1926, Robert Goddard launched the first liquid fuel rocket. In October 57, the Russians launched Sputnik. And then in July 1969, Neil Armstrong stepped out onto the moon, taking one small step for man, but one giant leap for mankind. Our immediate response as we think of these things, and you realize how little I've told you, our immediate response is to be overwhelmed when we see all that's happened. It has been a century of cataclysmic change. It's like rafting the turbulent white water of the mountains. What a ride. No wonder Toffler called it future shock, because the stress of all this change is so disorienting. And there is undoubtedly more to come. As we think of where we are now, for example, it seems to me most of us would agree we're in a period of tremendous social upheaval. And that's to be expected as we think of all the change that has kept occurring in staccato-like succession. There is that possibility of a shifting of the plates that may leave our landscape permanently altered when this period comes to an end. On a large scale, we're seeing that past understandings no longer satisfy people. And a new frame of reference is gradually being established. Now, what that will be and what it will mean is yet to be determined. But perhaps, as John Lukacs has put it, we may be witnessing not only the end of the modern period, but the end of the modern age itself. Vaclav Havel, in an address in New York, entitled The Search for Meaning in Global Civilization, said, "I think there are good reasons for suggesting that the modern age has ended. Today, many things indicate we are going through a transitional period where it seems that something is on the way out and something else is painfully being born." Samuel Huntington explains it as the clash of civilizations and the remaking of world order. Now, if that's so, it gives even more urgency to the need for us to extract worthwhile lessons and worthwhile lessons from our past that may be helpful in guiding us into our future. As the countdown to 2000 continues, we do well to review both recent and distant history, asking how and when we have been good stewards and how we can prepare for the challenges that are ahead of us. As Martin Marty put it, the raw material for our action will come from remembered ideas and words and events and images and models, so that our search for a usable future in any era will be grounded in our view of our particular past. Now, granted, that view will be selective and probably limited in its understanding and guided by our presuppositions or perspective, as anyone from Westminster would readily agree. We should be willing at the outset to admit that life is difficult. It is complex, and it is connected. And for that reason, it's sometimes difficult to analyze major changes or transitions and to get it all right. For example, you look back and you're surprised to discover that Louis XVI supposedly wrote in his diary on the day the Bastille fell, "Nothing happened." How easy it is to get it wrong. There are several ways that we can trace how we have arrived at our current condition. And I'm not going to take the time to try to do that, but I do want to give you an example or two that I think can be stimulating and worthwhile for us. And one of the ones we're not as likely to do is to trace it as Neil Postman does in his volume, Technopoly. Now, he does that by calling attention at the outset to three inventions that emerged from medieval Europe: the clock, the printing press, and the telescope. The clock, he says, changed our conception of time, becoming not only a means of keeping track of the hours, but of synchronizing and controlling the actions of people. And ultimately, that was what made capitalism possible, he argues. The press, he says, challenged the epistemology of the oral tradition. Luther, as you know, called it God's highest act of grace to drive the gospel forward. It's not exactly the way Postman would have put it, but he did see that it made a radical difference. As a matter of fact, he would have argued, after the press, you had not Europe plus the press, but a very different Europe. The telescope, he asserts, struck a telling blow at the prevailing authority of the Christian worldview because it brought to an end the prevailing geocentric view, and with it brought the demise of the moral center of gravity for the Western world. Now, I think that what Postman says and elaborates in some detail in Technopoly gives credence to an observation by Peter Berger. And that observation of Berger's is in his book, The Homeless Mind. Commissioned by American businesses to research undeveloped or third world countries in order to determine what the future might be for American capitalism and how what was out there might drive our economic engines of the future, he made some fascinating discoveries as he became more interested, particularly in Latin America. This book was a serendipity of that research, published separately from his other findings. He said this essentially. He said, "Our modern, urban, high-tech world, now present in these other countries as well, so that globally we have a high-tech, urban world, has bred some unexpected commonalities. Bureaucracy, loss of identity, loss of community, and erosion of values. And these problems represent the cultural crisis in which we find ourselves at the close of the 20th century." Now, looking at what Berger says, you can appreciate how Postman talks about the way in which an innovation or invention is introduced into society and, as adapted, becomes an inexorable force moving forward so that eventually, he says, it brings a culture into crisis. And that becomes a thesis. Here Berger is underscoring that. We are living in a world in which we have embraced the kind of change that technology can bring to us because we love all these gadgets. I mean, isn't it wonderful to come in and click on your TV and surf with your remote and see what's on and have all those choices? I remember it was about the time I was here at seminary. I heard someone say, someday you'll be able to have 70 different channels. And I thought, there is no way. And when cable first came, I knew there was no way. We had 15 choices on cable. I had 3 choices of NBC and 3 of CBS and so on. Now, look where we are. And most of us love all of these things. Cell phones and faxes and microwaves and the like. But we forget that with all of these things, now in our world of tightly clustered people in the big cities, we have bred a new environment and created a new set of problems we have failed to understand. Now, taking that, rather than merely a litany of intellectual developments, we can look at an example or two in the history of the church and perhaps extrapolate something from that. I would say one valuable thing for us to do might be to juxtapose the rise of Christianity in its pluralistic context against our own day. Newbegin and others have pointed out some of the commonalities of these two periods. Let me suggest that the effectiveness of Christianity during that period was associated with a winsome expression of community and morality in addition to the joyful embrace and promulgation of the gospel. We are well aware of the evangelistic impulse and courage that fueled the growth of the church in its early period. And we can appreciate the statement that the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. It certainly got the attention of pagans who couldn't help but ask, why do they do it? What drives these people? Now, there's another side to the story too, though. One that we sometimes miss. And it's another kind of courage. Recently, I was looking at a volume by Rodney Stark on the rise of Christianity and was reminded of the way in which the church faced disease and death in that period. Now, as you know, the cities of the old world were crowded, I mean really crowded, far more densely crowded than we are today. And they did not have modern sanitation. I visited some of those sites and been impressed with what was built, with the beauty, with the efficiency. But I can tell you, I would not have wanted to live in those conditions, and neither would you. Given those crowded conditions without the sanitary provisions we have today, you can understand why disease, if present, could become epidemic, as was sometimes the case. And when it was the case, the results were absolutely devastating. There was, for example, the plague of Galen in 165. And estimates are that 25% to a third of the population died as a result of the plague. Some estimates are higher than that. About 100 years later, in 251, there was another major plague. And the estimates were as many as 5,000 people a day were dying in Rome alone. I mean, this is a serious problem. Given these circumstances, we find a remarkable courage and compassion demonstrated by the Lord's people. They remain through those epidemics to nurse the sick, bury the dead, and offer hope and comfort. They were not afraid to die. They had already demonstrated that in other ways. But as things turned out, their mortality rate was actually lower than their pagan peers who panicked. And that's what those people did. They saw people begin to die around them. They panicked and they ran for the hills, leaving the bodies where they were to rot and stink. And the Christians did the opposite. As a matter of fact, not only taking care of their own, but taking care of neighbors and associates. And you can imagine the reaction of people as they saw how these Christians behaved under those circumstances. And you can imagine how surprised they were that some of them survived. It's one thing to survive 21 years as seminary president. It's another one to survive an epidemic when people are dropping like flies on every side. I'm amazed sometimes when people survive serious bouts with cancer and other diseases. But I can hardly imagine what this would have been like. And to have had the courage when you didn't understand what was happening and how to cope with it, to stay right there and compassionately, mercifully do something in the name of the Lord, that was a powerful demonstration of true faith and commitment. And the changed lives of these believers, I think, were demonstrated in other ways that were equally powerful too. I wish I had time to develop that in some detail. Let me simply point to one or two things. One interesting development, I think, was the high level of moral sensitivity that developed among believers. With that, a commitment to the sanctity of life, a commitment to the importance of marriage and family, a commitment to honesty and integrity, that made them very good citizens, supportive of their nation. And as we look at these, I remind you that in that day, the exposure of infants was a common practice. The exposure of infants is simply a euphemistic way of saying, if your wife had a baby and you did not want that baby, you simply put it outside and you let it die or let somebody take it. You put the baby on the garbage heap. And typically, female babies were not wanted if they were born first. You wanted a male child. Now, that was a lot tougher even than what we face today. Can you imagine what it took to do that as a common practice? But it was. Christians came along and they were different. They understood God said, you do not kill. So, you had a daughter. What'd you do? Now, the one thing I realize in presenting information like this is how easy it is to intellectualize this stuff in some objective way and be very detached about it. But let me give you an illustration that will drive it home. When I was a student here at Westminster, my wife in the first trimester was exposed to German measles. And the doctor said, I recommend an abortion. In those days, abortions were not readily recommended. He thought, given the circumstances, that was probably what she ought to do. And we weren't prepared to deal with that. Now, we knew what was right. We knew it intellectually. We knew in our hearts what was the right thing to do. And we went back to the doctor and we said, we don't want to do that. She took whatever precautions she could, and there were some things she could do. And I would like to tell you that was the end of it. But the next few months were very difficult. This was the period of the thalidomide babies. Do you remember that? Women who took thalidomide and had children who were deformed, sometimes without arms or legs, sometimes with all kinds of grotesque features. And these were appearing, the photographs of some of these children were appearing in the paper. And I had someone pass on a sermon to me about a couple who had a mongoloid child and how they dealt with that. And I can tell you, I'm an optimistic person. But I couldn't help but think about all the possible things that could go wrong. And I wondered if we had a child who had some severe problems, what were we going to do about that? How are we going to deal with this thing? And it comes back to you every day. And you pray, you trust the Lord, but there it is, and you face it. Now, as it turned out, when the delivery time came, it was my wife's easiest, best delivery, and a marvelous daughter. And to this day, the fact that we made that decision and stuck with it is a tremendously powerful testimony in her own life. Later, we had a lot of difficulty with another delivery and another child. And we've learned so much about the providential provision of the Lord through all those experiences. But I'll tell you this, when I think back to that experience and how hard it was, I can transpose myself a whole lot more easily into this period and think of what went on and some of the emotional, psychological struggles that were a part of this whole thing. These were people like you and me. And they're going through all these experiences, and the faith is becoming real. What they believe and are now committed to is being tested. And in the crucible of that testing, their own commitment is coming powerfully to light. We are different. We will not be like these other people. We will not put our children out on the pile to die. And even if we face death, we're going to stay here in the middle of this sickness and stench and take care of the people we love. As you can imagine, there were more women Christians. That's one statistic that makes sense. And I can imagine Christianity looked a whole lot more attractive to women after a little while. As a matter of fact, I can understand why one emperor sometime later said, "I forbid you Christians to go and witness to pagan women." Interesting, isn't it? Then we learn that at a later time, the year 362, the Emperor Julian started pagan charities to compete with and to match the Christian ones, observing that the impious Galileans support not only their poor, but ours as well. And I think, boy, what a turn of events compared to our day. Now, in spite of World Vision, Samaritan's Purse, orphanages, and the like, this is not the image of contemporary evangelical Christianity, is it? What you find in this period of the rise of Christianity. Too often today, we're seen as critical and mean-spirited, judgmental, hard to live with, and not compassionate. Too often, evangelical Christianity is seen in the light of shootings at an abortion clinic or the death of a gay man in Wyoming. And when people look for examples of compassion, they think of Mother Teresa and Catholicism. As a matter of fact, there was more response to the death of Princess Di than there has been to the real example of evangelical Christianity. And it's not that we aren't compassionate, caring, but in some way, our emphases have developed differently, and the perception of the public is totally different. And we have to admit, in the history of our country, Christianity, largely through our Puritan Reform forebears, established a value system that made us in this country a very generous, caring people. We have been generous as a people. And we are ones who have reached out to the rest of the world, caring and giving and doing good and healing. And yet, where are we as evangelicals? We're known for our firm convictions, but are we known for compassion? Are we known for the kind of caring attitude that marked the early believers? Today, we are thought to seek political power in order to coerce others into conformity with our own convictions. And that if our convictions were tempered more by love and compassion, then our insistence on obedience and faith might be received by an unbelieving world much more kindly. When you think of it, this is the kind of lesson Francis Schaeffer said he learned during the church conflict and struggles early in this century, when he later urged us to remember that the mark of a Christian is love. Now, before I leave this period, just reflect for a moment more on the matter of women and evangelicalism, or Reformed evangelicals. Historically, Christianity has been one of women's greatest friends and advocates. The Christian faith has done so much to benefit women and to elevate their status. During the period of the early church, Christianity, as a result, had the loyal, unswerving support of believing women and many who were not believers. And through their network of contacts, who knows how many people were converted. By contrast, the role of evangelicals today, primarily because of the way we have addressed the issue of women's ordination, has been construed negatively. I remember talking to someone who said to me, if it were not for my love for the Lord, I would be a militant feminist. And I thought to myself, this is not what we intend. How did we let it happen this way? And I'm reminded of what happened early in the century. You know, right at the close of the 19th century, there was one denomination that used on its letterhead the cup of cold water as a logo. By the time the fundamentalist-modernist controversy ended, they had removed that from their letterhead. Didn't want to have a thing to do with it because that's the way the liberals and the social gospel people were. And sometimes we've allowed our own priorities to be distorted by the things we've experienced rather than guided by the scriptures and by the better examples of our past history. The experience of these things during the period of the early church undoubtedly bonded believers so that there was, in spite of the doctrinal controversies and the ecumenical councils that marked this period of time, there was a sense of community. They belonged. Their identity and their sense of purpose was clear. And as the community of faith, they took up the challenge of building the city of God. Then quickly, let's consider the Reformation, and it won't take long. Not that it isn't worth a long time, but we don't have it. Occurring during a period of remarkable stimulus and change when there were lots of inventions, a new world had been discovered, exploration was occurring everywhere, all kinds of new things were happening, the church was out of touch with its people. It had become a bloated bureaucratic money machine, lost respect during the divided papacy and failed to regain that. And during that same period, political leverage became more apparent, and no longer did the church command the love and loyalty of its people as it once had. Luther and the Reformation offered to reform the whole rotten mess and put people directly in touch with God. That's what they were looking for. They could read God's word in their own language. They could pray directly to Him. Worship was enlivened. New songs were written. Laity were empowered. Calvin stressed the knowledge of God as the most important thing of all. And piety benefited. In our day, evangelicals have labored to preserve the truth, the authority of Scripture, the power of the gospel, and done that well over against the liberal drift of the mainline denominations. Spiritual renewal, biblical fidelity have been hallmarks. The flowering of the charismatic movement and church renewal have brought a new, fresh emphasis on personal piety, from which many of us have benefited. And yet, we may wonder what our successes have lost for us. Has the democratization of the church, the lessened value of labels, the proliferation of voluntary associations, and churches and parachurch groups and the like, eroded our identity and community so much that now we're more concerned to be successful than to please God? Have we lost the beauty and harmony that should mark the fellowship of the Spirit? Or can we find a way to love God and love one another? The heart cry of our era is for authentic spirituality, a genuine recovery of transcendence in worship and daily life. The Reformation offered that, and now we must move beyond the assertion of correct doctrine, growing numbers, and organizational prowess to a humble, obedient hearing of the still small voice. And moreover, we need to discover again the humility to admit our own sinfulness in order to walk the path of obedience. Right now, the world has invaded the church, and so much so that we are embarrassed to note that our behavior differs little from non-church people. Unless we demonstrate the kind of character and integrity worthy of our confession, why should we expect anyone else to switch or even think about it? If we believe in the merit of virtue, then it's time for some among us to stand tall for justice and honesty and integrity. As we reflect on the mounting culture wars of our own period and the frustration, the stress, and the searching that we experience, we cannot help but be reminded of the solid foundation laid by our forebears, and particularly by Luther, Calvin, and our Puritan forebears. We have lived off that legacy for many years. And now, during the current period of social disintegration, we find a prime opportunity for Reformed evangelicals to step to the fore, assisting in the understanding and articulation of a coherent Christian worldview. This could be the hour again for Reformed people. Remember the nursery rhyme you learned as a child? Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall. Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. All the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty Dumpty back together again. That's our world today. Multiple worldviews, pluralistic, no answers. But as we heard earlier tonight, we have an answer, and we have a redemptive answer. We can offer that coherent answer and solution to those who are around us. The history of the Lord's people reminds us that faithfulness to Him and the desire to be among His people, combined with an enthusiastic desire to evangelize others, is essential to our future. Now add to that the importance of character and caring, and you can develop an agenda for the next century. Certainly, we need not be afraid of the future. For our security is in the Lord. The greater is the one who is in us than the one who is in the world. And we are convinced that if He is for us, it doesn't matter who or what is against us. Our task is to look at what's happened, look at what is happening, and to be good stewards to manage the change in which we find ourselves so that the Lord will be exalted. And now when things seem the worst, may be our greatest opportunity.
Thank you very much. Dr. Whitlock is willing to answer a few questions. We won't make this long because we've had a long day tomorrow, but it's our custom after major address to have a time for questions. So if you have a question, you will find an usher coming down the aisle with a mic, so that, not to intimidate you, but so that everybody else can hear you. So please raise your hand and speak into the mic, and Dr. Whitlock will answer. Who's first? There's one down in the middle there.
You said a culture in crisis becomes a thesis, and we've embraced technology and the choices it's offered. Could you comment on this internet culture? And what new thesis it is creating for both Christians and non-Christians?
I did say that the thesis Postman postulates is that as you have an invention and it enters the mainstream of use and adaptation, ultimately, he argues, it brings the culture into crisis. It does bring a change. He would say, look at television. here in this country, you do not have the United States plus television. It changes everything. It changes politics. It changes the way we think and process information and everything. Now, we look at the Internet as an example of that, and we say, here again, we have an example of another kind of invention coming on stream. And we find that it is very attractive for a number of reasons. And these have an allure, all of them. I'm not putting myself in the position of being a Luddite on any of this. What I am doing, though, is trying to say, while all of these may be of benefit, let's be aware of what the fallout may be on the other side. We say sometimes you have a strength, the correlative is your weakness, and you need to see how both fit together. We say the Internet is going to provide a tremendous amount of information. It will give ready access to all of us, and it is absolutely amazing. I turn on my computer, hit the button to get on the Internet, and my problem is there is so much stuff there, I don't know what to do with it. And what we have is almost an information overload for many of us at this point. We have to learn how to respond to and process that. Now, just the fact of what we do with mass amounts of information we've never had access to before is going to be one thing. Second is we have to begin to think through our responsibility in dealing with all of these things. Let me give you a different example. When Nesbitt was doing his book, Megatrends, you may recall, he said, where you have high tech, you need high touch. Because we say, Ma Bell gives us the capacity to just reach out and touch someone, and yet, here we are living closer together than ever before, with more ability to be in touch than ever before, by telephone, by fax, by email, and the like. And what's happened? We seem really to have regressed in our ability to communicate, to bond, to develop community. There seem to be more problems than ever, not less, as a result of all of these things. So they have tremendous potential benefit, but we must take those and look at the trade-offs and compensate appropriately. And it seems to me that's the lesson that's there. And if you don't compensate appropriately, you're gonna really suffer the consequences on the bad side.
Dr. Whitlock, you mentioned the church as the benefactor of women historically, and the tensions that seem to have arisen at the moment centered around the ordination of women, perhaps, and suggesting, I'm not sure quite what, in terms of where the trajectory or what the lesson of the past might be toward the future regarding the role of women.
Well, I wasn't suggesting any specific course of action, as you noticed, which you seem to have noticed. And I was really trying to provide this information in a way that would make us sensitive to the fact that perhaps in our concern to deal with one issue, we've created another kind of problem. And that, again, is the answer I gave to the first question. Is sometimes you're attempting to do this, and you do, but there are other consequences that you haven't thought of. And then you have to deal with those. And it seems to me one of the things that is true of those of us who really believe the Scriptures is that we are committed to the truth that every person is made in the image of God, that in Christ there is neither male nor female, and that we have to find a way to take this seriously. I work with the person for whom I have great admiration. His name is James Hurley. And he is just a marvelous person, a wonderful scholar. He wrote a book called Men and Women in Biblical Perspective. I think that book does an admirable job of trying to create the right sort of balance in these things. And it seems to me our task today as Reformed evangelicals is to be sure that we are accurately representing what the Scriptures call us to believe and live. And then that we do that in such a way that we accurately represent ourselves to those around us. I'm not sure that what we have done in recent years gives the kind of comprehensive, accurate picture that ought to be presented of what we really do believe. Now, taking that, rather than merely a litany of intellectual developments, we can look at an example or two in the history of the church and perhaps extrapolate something from that. I would say one valuable thing for us to do might be to juxtapose the rise of Christianity in its pluralistic context against our own day. Neubingen and others have pointed out some of the commonalities of these two periods. Let me suggest that the effectiveness of Christianity during that period was associated with a winsome expression of community and morality in addition to the joyful embrace and promulgation of the gospel. We are well aware of the evangelistic impulse and courage that fueled the growth of the church in its early period. And we can appreciate the statement that the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. It certainly got the attention of pagans who couldn't help but ask, why do they do it? What drives these people? Now, there's another side to the story too, though. One that we sometimes miss. And it's another kind of courage. But recently I was looking at a volume by Rodney Stark on the rise of Christianity and was reminded of the way in which the church faced disease and death in that period. Now, as you know, the cities of the old world were crowded. I mean really crowded. Far more densely crowded than we are today. And they did not have modern sanitation. I visited some of those sites and been impressed with what was built, with the beauty, with the efficiency. But I can tell you, I would not have wanted to live in those conditions, and neither would you. Given those crowded conditions without the sanitary provisions we have today, you can understand why disease, if present, could become epidemic, as was sometimes the case. And when it was the case, the results were absolutely devastating. There was, for example, the plague of Galen in 165. And estimates are that 25% to a third of the population died as a result of the plague. Some estimates are higher than that. About 100 years later, in 251, there was another major plague. And the estimates were as many as 5,000 people a day were dying in Rome alone. I mean, this is a serious problem. Given these circumstances, we find a remarkable courage and compassion demonstrated by the Lord's people. They remained through those epidemics to nurse the sick, bury the dead, and offer hope and comfort. They were not afraid to die. They had already demonstrated that in other ways. But as things turned out, their mortality rate was actually lower than their pagan peers who panicked. And that's what those people did. They saw people begin to die around them. They panicked and they ran for the hills, leaving the bodies where they were to rot and stink. And the Christians did the opposite. As a matter of fact, not only taking care of their own, but taking care of neighbors and associates. And you can imagine the reaction of people as they saw how these Christians behaved under those circumstances. And you can imagine how surprised they were that some of them survived. It's one thing to survive 21 years as seminary president. It's another one to survive an epidemic when people are dropping like flies on every side. I'm amazed sometimes when people survive serious bouts with cancer and other diseases. But I can hardly imagine what this would have been like. And to have had the courage, when you didn't understand what was happening and how to cope with it, to stay right there and compassionately, mercifully do something in the name of the Lord, that was a powerful demonstration of true faith and commitment. And the changed lives of these believers, I think, were demonstrated in other ways that were equally powerful too. I wish I had time to develop that in some detail. Let me simply point to one or two things. One interesting development, I think, was the high level of moral sensitivity that developed among believers. With that, a commitment to the sanctity of life, a commitment to the importance of marriage and family, a commitment to honesty and integrity that made them very good citizens, supportive of their nation. And as we look at these, I remind you that in that day, the exposure of infants was a common practice. The exposure of infants is simply a euphemistic way of saying, if your wife had a baby and you did not want that baby, you simply put it outside and you'd let it die or let somebody take it. You put the baby on the garbage heap. And typically, female babies were not wanted if they were born first. You wanted a male child. Now, that was a lot tougher even than what we face today. Can you imagine what it took to do that as a common practice? But it was. Christians came along and they were different. They understood God said you do not kill. So, you had a daughter. What'd you do? Now, the one thing I realize in presenting information like this is how easy it is to intellectualize this stuff in some objective way and be very detached about it. But let me give you an illustration that will drive it home. When I was a student here at Westminster, my wife in the first trimester was exposed to German measles. And the doctor said, I recommend an abortion. In those days, abortions were not readily recommended. He thought, given the circumstances, that was probably what she ought to do. And we weren't prepared to deal with that. Now, we knew what was right. We knew it intellectually. We knew in our hearts what was the right thing to do. And we went back to the doctor and we said, we don't want to do that. She took whatever precautions she could, and there were some things she could do. And I would like to tell you that was the end of it. But the next few months were very difficult. This was the period of the thalidomide babies. Do you remember that? Women who took thalidomide and had children who were deformed, sometimes without arms or legs, sometimes with all kinds of grotesque features. And these were appearing, the photographs of some of these children were appearing in the paper. And I had someone pass on a sermon to me about a couple who had a mongoloid child and how they dealt with that. And I can tell you, I'm an optimistic person, but I couldn't help but think about all the possible things that could go wrong. And I wondered, if we had a child who had some severe problems, what were we going to do about that? How are we going to deal with this thing? And it comes back to you every day. And you pray, you trust the Lord, but there it is, and you face it. Now, as it turned out, when the delivery time came, it was my wife's easiest, best delivery, and a marvelous daughter. And to this day, the fact that we made that decision and stuck with it is a tremendously powerful testimony in her own life. Later, we had a lot of difficulty with another delivery and another child. And we've learned so much about the providential provision of the Lord through all those experiences. But I'll tell you this, when I think back to that experience and how hard it was, I can transpose myself a whole lot more easily into this period and think of what went on, and some of the emotional, psychological struggles that were a part of this whole thing. I mean, these were people like you and me, and they're going through all these experiences, and the faith is becoming real. What they believe and are now committed to is being tested. And in the crucible of that testing, their own commitment is coming powerfully to light. We are different. We will not be like these other people. We will not put our children out on the pile to die. And even if we face death, we're going to stay here in the middle of this sickness and stench and take care of the people we love. As you can imagine, there were more women Christians. That's one statistic that makes sense. And I can imagine Christianity looked a whole lot more attractive to women after a little while. As a matter of fact, I can understand why one emperor sometime later said, "I forbid you Christians to go and witness to pagan women." Interesting, isn't it? Then we learn that at a later time, the year 362, the Emperor Julian started pagan charities to compete with and to match the Christian ones, observing that the impious Galileans support not only their poor, but ours as well. And I think, boy, what a turn of events compared to our day. Now, in spite of World Vision, Samaritans, Purse, orphanages, and the like, this is not the image of contemporary evangelical Christianity, is it? What you find in this period of the rise of Christianity. Too often today, we are seen as critical and mean-spirited, judgmental, hard to live with, and not compassionate. Too often, evangelical Christianity is seen in the light of shootings at an abortion clinic or the death of a gay man in Wyoming. And when people look for examples of compassion, they think of Mother Teresa and Catholicism. As a matter of fact, there was more response to the death of Princess Di than there has been to the real example of evangelical Christianity. And it's not that we aren't compassionate, caring, but in some way, our emphases have developed differently, and the perception of the public is totally different. And we have to admit, in the history of our country, Christianity, largely through our Puritan Reformed forebears, established a value system that made us in this country a very generous, caring people. We have been generous as a people. And we are ones who have reached out to the rest of the world, caring and giving and doing good and healing. And yet, where are we as evangelicals? We're known for our firm convictions, but are we known for compassion? Are we known for the kind of caring attitude that marked the early believers? Today, we're thought to seek political power in order to coerce others into conformity with our own convictions. And that if our convictions were tempered more by love and compassion, then our insistence on obedience and faith might be received by an unbelieving world much more kindly. When you think of it, this is the kind of lesson Francis Schaeffer said he learned during the church conflict and struggles early in this century, when he later urged us to remember that the mark of a Christian is love. Now, before I leave this period, I just reflect for a moment more on the matter of women and evangelicalism, or Reformed evangelicals. Historically, Christianity has been one of women's greatest friends and advocates. The Christian faith has done so much to benefit women and to elevate their status. During the period of the early church, Christianity, as a result, had the loyal, unswerving support of believing women and many who were not believers. And through their network of contacts, who knows how many people were converted. By contrast, the role of evangelicals today, primarily because of the way we have addressed the issue of women's ordination, has been construed negatively. I remember talking to someone who said to me, if it were not for my love for the Lord, I would be a militant feminist. And I thought to myself, this is not what we intend. How did we let it happen this way? And I'm reminded of what happened early in the century. You know, right at the close of the 19th century, there was one denomination that used on its letterhead the cup of cold water as a logo. By the time the fundamentalist modernist controversy ended, they had removed that from their letterhead. Didn't want to have a thing to do with it because that's the way the liberals and the social gospel people work. And sometimes we've allowed our own priorities to be distorted by the things we've experienced rather than guided by the scriptures and by the better examples of our past history. The experience of these things during the period of the early church undoubtedly bonded believers so that there was, in spite of the doctrinal controversies and the ecumenical councils that marked this period of time, there was a sense of community. They belonged. Their identity and their sense of purpose was clear. And as the community of faith, they took up the challenge of building the city of God. And quickly, let's consider the Reformation, and it won't take long. Not that it isn't worth a long time, but we don't have it. Occurring during a period of remarkable stimulus and change when there were lots of inventions, a new world had been discovered, exploration was occurring everywhere, all kinds of new things were happening. The church was out of touch with its people. It had become a bloated bureaucratic money machine. Lost respect during the divided papacy and failed to regain that. And during that same period, political leverage became more apparent. And no longer did the church command the love and loyalty of its people as it once had. Luther and the Reformation offered to reform the whole rotten mess and put people directly in touch with God. That's what they were looking for. They could read God's word in their own language. They could pray directly to him. Worship was enlivened. New songs were written. Laity were empowered. Calvin stressed the knowledge of God as the most important thing of all. And piety benefited. In our day, evangelicals have labored to preserve the truth, the authority of Scripture, the power of the gospel, and done that well over against the liberal drift of the mainline denominations. Spiritual renewal, biblical fidelity have been hallmarks. The flowering of the charismatic movement and church renewal have brought a new, fresh emphasis on personal piety from which many of us have benefited. And yet, we may wonder what our successes have lost for us. Has the democratization of the church, the lessened value of labels, the proliferation of voluntary associations, churches and parachurch groups and the like, eroded our identity and community so much that now we're more concerned to be successful than to please God? Have we lost the beauty and harmony that should mark the fellowship of the Spirit? Or can we find a way to love God and love one another? The heart cry of our era is for authentic spirituality, a genuine recovery of transcendence in worship and daily life. The Reformation offered that, and now we must move beyond the assertion of correct doctrine, growing numbers, and organizational prowess to a humble, obedient hearing of the still small voice. And moreover, we need to discover again the humility to admit our own sinfulness in order to walk the path of obedience. Right now, the world has invaded the church, and so much so that we are embarrassed to note that our behavior differs little from non-church people. Unless we demonstrate the kind of character and integrity worthy of our confession, why should we expect anyone else to switch or even think about it? If we believe in the merit of virtue, then it's time for some among us to stand tall for justice and honesty and integrity. As we reflect on the mounting culture wars of our own period and the frustration, the stress, and the searching that we experience, we cannot help but be reminded of the solid foundation laid by our forebears, and particularly by Luther, Calvin, and our Puritan forebears. We have lived off that legacy for many years. And now, during the current period of social disintegration, we find a prime opportunity for Reformed evangelicals to step to the fore, assisting in the understanding and articulation of a coherent Christian worldview. This could be the hour again for Reformed people. Remember the nursery rhyme you learned as a child? Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall. Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. All the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty Dumpty back together again. That's our world today. Multiple worldviews, pluralistic, no answers. But as we heard earlier tonight, we have an answer, and we have a redemptive answer. We can offer that coherent answer and solution to those who are around us. The history of the Lord's people reminds us that faithfulness to Him and the desire to be among His people, combined with an enthusiastic desire to evangelize others, is essential to our future. Now add to that the importance of character and caring, and you can develop an agenda for the next century. Certainly, we need not be afraid of the future, for our security is in the Lord. The greater is the one who is in us than the one who is in the world. And we're convinced that if He is for us, it doesn't matter who or what is against us. Our task is to look at what's happened, look at what is happening, and to be good stewards to manage the change in which we find ourselves so that the Lord will be exalted. And now when things seem the worst, may be our greatest opportunity.